Oh, hey there. You like true crime stories, right? Yeah, I know. Who doesn't? But I gotta admit, after a while, all those stories of murder and heartache, well, they tend to go straight to my hips. So that's why I, Leroy Luna, have created a podcast called Excuse Me, That's Illegal, where we'll take a hardcore look at some softcore crimes. No TED Talks on Bundy here. The letters BTK won't be coming from these lips. Unless he had a brother that used to steal library books. Suppose I'd be willing to go balls deep into that one if that were the case. Anyways, you'll hear stories such as the Mad Pooper, a female jogger who wreaked havoc in a Colorado Springs neighborhood, using one family's front yard as her own personal dumping grounds. If this kind of content sounds like it's up your alley, Excuse Me, That's Illegal, is available right now on all your favorite podcatchers. So come join me.
I'll be right here waiting for you.
Welcome. So I'm Eric Carter Londeen. I'm the host and producer and all kinds of other things for True Consequences podcast. It's a true crime podcast based in New Mexico, which is where I live. Welcome. I created the show because I have a murder victim in my family who has not received justice yet, my baby brother Jacob. And so I created the show to advocate for Jacob, but to also help other people in my community who are fighting for justice, which is why I'm hyper-focused on New Mexico. Also, New Mexico is really weird, so there's a lot of other stuff that I talk about New Mexico being weird. Yeah?
Before you jump into the next person, you're going to remember your other podcast?
I do have another podcast, and Whitney had to remind me because the last two nights I've forgotten. So I have a paranormal comedy podcast called Dos Pequeños. You probably see the two little ghosts on one of those stickers over there. I'm the co-ghost. My other co-ghost is back in Albuquerque, but it's a funny look at the paranormal. And how about you ladies?
So my name is Whitney. I am one half of Cults, Crimes, and Cabernet. We are also a true crime podcast, and we go state by state, cover unsolved cases from season 3 forward. Once a quarter, we'd go out, travel different locations, meet with family members, and do whatever we can to help them. Foot searches, hand out flyers. There's lots of different aspects to advocacy. And this is Melissa.
Yes, I'm Melissa. And one of the things that we had actually accomplished, and it was kind of one of our goals when we started this, helping families, we went out on a foot search for the Brandon Lawson case out of San Angelo, Texas, and we ended up finding evidence that of his location, last known location, and law enforcement ended up going out afterwards and finding human remains. He was missing for 8.5 years. It's still in DNA testing process now, but from where we found articles of clothing that he was last wearing, it was about 400 yards away was the human remains. So we're pretty confident it's him, but still waiting for DNA testing. And then this is Bob.
Hi, I'm Bob Mata. I am the host of a little podcast called Defense Diaries. I am a recovering criminal defense attorney turned podcaster. Started the show about 1.5 years ago. We are currently in our second season. The first season covered John Wayne Gacy, but in a much different way. My father happened to represent him back in 1978. For my 21st birthday, he left me all his taped interviews pre-trial with Gacy. I held on to him for 30 years and then finally decided to do a podcast about it. We're pretty proud of the show. We think it's amazing. We think it's a definitive thing that's ever been done on Gacy. So if you're into long-form, serialized podcasts, I think you should probably check our show out. Second season is a case that I actually handled as a trial attorney. in Omaha, Nebraska back in 2016. And it's another horrible, devastating case where, you know, four people lost their lives. But we take a different look at it from the defense attorney's perspective. And it's pretty interesting. I think it's, I feel confident in saying there's not many podcasts out there that do what we do, just in terms of kind of my knowledge of the criminal justice system. So we try to inform our listeners in a way that's entertaining and not boring. So if you haven't listened, again, it's called Defense Diaries. We have our merch all over the place. Grab it so you can remember the names of all of our shows if you haven't listened to all of them, because they're all great podcasts. So welcome. Thank you guys for coming.
We are so glad that you're here. We just drove in from Dallas, but we do have one Texan here, recovering Texan here, and
also, briefly recovering Texan.
Yeah,
it's been a couple of years.
Here. And Bob's from Chicago. I'm from New Mexico, but I lived in Texas a while. So tonight we're gonna do a few things. We're gonna talk about some current true crime events, just to kind of get the mood going. And then we're going to go into a recent serial killer from Fort Worth that so far nobody has known about at the shows. So if you know about it, then you'll be the first one.
And it's a very recent case. Yeah. Very recent. Very recent. The last year.
Year, yeah. But let's get into what is the most pressing current true crime news. And so I'm going to ask Bob to kind of kick us off here, because he is the legal expert among us. We're going to talk about Adnan Syed and his release.
So who out there has heard about Adnan Syed? Any of you guys? Any of you guys? Yeah.
Oh, awesome. On HBO? Yes.
Has anybody listened to Serial or Undisclosed?
Undisclosed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you guys are, I'm assuming you're all aware of what's going on with the case, right? So last week, Monday, after 23 years, Adnan's conviction was vacated by Judge Finn in Baltimore. The interesting thing about what happened is that after all these years, it was actually the prosecutor's office that had filed the motion to vacate the conviction, which, as a criminal defense attorney, in all honesty, in my 20-plus years of practicing, I have never seen a prosecutor do that, or they've done a complete 180 and dug back into the case and said, you know what, we don't think this guy got a fair trial. So where it stands right now is that Syed is out, he's on home detention, and there's a distinction. He is not a free man. He's free from prison, but he's not a free man yet. So that is going to happen. Theoretically, it should happen within 30 days if they are not going to retry him. So essentially what's going to happen is the state, in particular Marilyn Mosby, who is my favorite prosecutor ever, she's going to have to make a decision. And it's going to be based, I think, primarily on this DNA that they're waiting for. So there's, you know, in my estimation, I don't know what you guys think about it, I'm fairly certain they have a pretty strong case built against one of these two mystery suspects. I think that they are waiting for the final piece of evidence that they believe will be enough for them to move forward with a trial. Because, I mean, if you look at what they attacked in their motion to vacate, it's pretty clear that they have no evidence that is viable in terms of going and retrying Adnan. So I think that it's going to happen in short order. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on them to get the DNA done in a timely fashion, because, you know, essentially they have to nolliprost, which just is a Latin term for dismiss the case in 30 days or set it for trial. So I'm blown away by what's been going on with the whole thing, and I couldn't be more excited about the concept of justice over convictions, which is what every prosecutor that I've ever met or ever have known has valued. And it's not the way that it should be. The way it should always be is justice over convictions, not convictions over justice. So I'm really excited about it.
So I agree. I really doubt they're going to retry Adnan. Considering they only have that 30 days, not all the DNA's back, I feel like if they really, they wouldn't have released him yet if they thought he did it. And then that bombshell about being two other suspects, which if any of the documentaries, most of them really don't talk about anyone else besides Adnan. And that shocked me. But apparently there's an even larger bombshell that hasn't been released yet, and that's mind-boggling.
I agree with both of you. I don't think they would have pursued this if they didn't have an alternate route that they were planning on taking as the state, another suspect, more evidence out there. And I have a question for Bob.
Yes.
Do you think that the speediness in which this happened with Adnan, do you think that's going to set precedent for every other state to get their shit together?
I mean, when you're talking about the speediness, it took 23 years.
I'm talking about from the motion to his release.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, the victim side of that was very problematic for me. You know, young Lee, who's Heyman's brother, obviously wanted to be there to represent the interests of the family. I think he would have liked to have been able to make a victim impact statement. The way that I understand that it went down from the state when they argued their motion on Monday is that they had sent young Lee an advanced copy of the motion on Tuesday.
And that's Hayes' brother, right?
Correct.
The victim's
correct.
Brother.
Correct.
Victim's brother.
Hayes' brother, correct. And that followed up with a short phone call, obviously not taking enough time to explain to this poor man exactly what the hell was going on. I mean, essentially, they're saying, look, we're vacating this conviction that we told you 23 years ago was rock solid. And that family has relied on that for the last 23 years. And you know, from a victim's family perspective, you have to always think about the appellate process. Because from that victim's family's perspective, they don't know how the system works. They don't understand how appeals work. They don't understand what's going on. So every time it comes back up into court, from a layman's perspective, they're sitting there thinking, what the fuck? Is this guy going to get off? You know, because the state doesn't sit there and hold people's hands in terms of victims' families and say, hey, you know, we're going to walk you step by step through this process and let you know what's going on. They don't do that. So you have these families that have gone through the worst experience of their entire life that have to continue to relive it and relive it and relive it and relive it again. And unfortunately, they're in the same place right now. And because of the speediness that it actually was filed, in Illinois, it's 5 days, 5 days notice. There, we're talking two business days because they were in court on Monday. Now, I had started a side podcast called Sidebar, and I covered Adnan in our first two episodes, and I had been searching diligently to see when the hell this thing was going to be up. And I didn't know until Monday when I think Lee Sunderland of the Baltimore Sun actually was live tweeting. And I found out that morning that the hearing was going that afternoon. So, you know, it wasn't on the docket because I was checking the docket to see when it was scheduled. So, yeah, I mean, I feel horrible for the family in that sense. You know, and you have to kind of balance it with Adnan if he is innocent. Indeed innocent, then he's been in jail for 23 years. You know, I mean, do you have to, you know, as a judge who denied the motion to continue the matter, you know, she must have felt that the motion was pretty strong in order for her to say, I want to hear it instanter. I'm not going to delay it any further. And, you know, I mean, unfortunately, the victims were victims once again in terms of not being able to be there and adequately represent how this is going to affect them. Their lives. So
I think it's really important to remember too, like, while it's probably great, depending on where you stand on this case, it's probably a really good thing to see that somebody who potentially was wrongfully convicted has been set free after so long. But to also think about Hayes' family and what it means for them to have to face another trial, because they probably believed in their heart of hearts they got the right person. And as a family member who has to deal with the legal system and with interacting with prosecutors, you want to trust them. You know, when you're forced in the situation, you want to believe that justice is fair and that it's going to prove, you know, who did it, and then they're going to be held responsible and held accountable. And so they've had 23 years of feeling like this was behind them. And now they have to start all over again. So I think that that's really important to keep in mind as we see people celebrating that Adnan was released. We also have to remember that the family is still left kind of holding the bag at this point.
And that's why we really have to believe, like, there's no way the city of Baltimore moved forward on this motion to vacate, not taking into consideration Haman Lee's family. Mm-hmm. You know, like they're not filing that motion unless they're extremely close to pressing charges against somebody else. It's not going to be Adnan. Like, we know that. There's no evidence that they have at this point. I mean, if they're left with Jay Wiles' testimony, which is for shit, you know, and we know the cell phone data, they're not going to be able to find an expert on the planet that's going to be able to go in and say that cell phone location data in 1999 could triangulate anything with any kind of specificity, you know? So, yeah. Like, essentially what they're left with is zero evidence to move forward on him. So we know without them saying it, because, you know, theoretically they are still in an investigation, so they're not going to release the names. Now, Reddit's been going crazy trying to figure out who the hell these people are. You know, we were trying to do it last night.
Yeah.
We were, you know, sitting there trying to figure out who it is. I mean, there's a lot of speculation out there. But, yeah, I mean, in terms of the family, and like Eric and I were both saying, you know, it's beyond that. I mean, I can tell you from being in these battles where victims are hearing what the state is saying, and they're more than trusting in it, they're relying on it.
They believe it
completely, to the extent to when you have an alternate suspect, or if somebody wins on appeal, it's hard to convince the victim's family because they believe so much in what they were told initially, and they believe in the process, that they find it hard to not think that the person that was originally convicted is not still the guy. You know, and that's just a fact, you know. So it's like they're like, I don't know who said it. I think Melissa actually said it, you know, that there were no winners in this case because Adnan, yes, he's out, but the man lost 23 years of his life if he's innocent. And obviously, Haman Lee lost her life. And that family has had to live through this nightmare for 23 years. So there's a lot of losers in this. And hopefully, the end game has to be that Haman Lee gets justice. I mean, that's got to be the end game.
But without Adnan getting out of prison, hey, if Adnan is innocent, there wouldn't be justice for Hay. Like, this exactly. Investigation had to go on. Adnan had to eventually get out of jail for the real perpetrator,
exactly,
for that investigation to go forward. So,
are you all aware of what happened and why this happened? Does anybody need that kind of background? You do? Okay. So I think maybe let Bob take that. It was a Brady violation, but Bob, you are the legal guy, so we're going to rely on you for this.
Yeah, so unbelievably, there exists in a majority of the states in our wonderful country, there exists no vehicle by which the state can actually file a motion to vacate. Like, if they've decided, ooh, we got the wrong guy, you know, we need an opportunity to be able to go in front of a judge and say, we missed on this one, you know. And until 2019, and it, oddly enough, if you guys have never watched on HBO Max, it's called We Own This City, and it's about the Gun Trace Task Force in Baltimore that is stunning. It is absolutely stunning, and it is about this task force with the Baltimore Police Department that was the most corrupt group of gentlemen that I have ever seen in my entire lives. These guys were the criminals. They were unbelievable. They were so terrible that the legislature in Maryland passed a bill in 2019 that allowed for state's attorneys to be able to vacate convictions that they may have won at trial based on bad evidence, whether it be planted evidence, whether it be coerced testimony, whether it be coerced confessions, what have you. So ultimately what happens is the city attorney ends up doing their own investigation, and it all comes from First Serial, which shone light onto the case, and it all comes from Rabia Chaudhry, who really was the advocate that said, hey, you know what, you need to look at this case, and she was just never stopping with her advocacy. I mean, she just was never going away. And so ultimately, you know, she got Sarah Koenig and NPR to do Serial. Serial is kind of what drew us all into podcasting in terms of like kind of falling in love with the medium. And, you know, from that, we had Undisclosed, which Rabia did her own podcast, because she, like, kind of the way I describe Serial is that they fumbled the ball at the end. Mm-hmm. Rabia picked it up and then crossed the goal line with it. So in conjunction with also the HBO documentary, which you guys, I think, said somebody in here said they're watching right now, those three things ultimately were able to weasel their way into the minds of the current prosecutor of, you know, the city of Baltimore, who's a woman named Marilyn Mosby. And she had her office say, hey, you know what, we're going to look at this case again. And they did. And they actually dug back into it. And because of that legislation that had just been passed in 2019, they ended up having the ability to be able to go on based on their investigation, as they saw that the case that this gentleman was tried on was not a fair trial. It just wasn't a fair trial. The evidence was tainted. And you know, the biggest thing I think that really turned them on their heels was the fact, are you guys familiar with what a Brady violation is? You ever heard of that term? Do you know what a Brady violation is? Anyone?
Explain it to us.
Bueller, voodoo, economic. Oh, sorry, I slipped into some Ferris Bueller there. So essentially, like the simplest way to put a Brady violation is essentially it's where the state withholds exculpatory evidence from the defense.
What does exculpatory mean?
Exculpatory means that it tends to show the innocence of the defendant. Evidence that tends to show the evidence or the innocence of the defendant. So what they found was basically mind-blowing in terms of it was these two suspects that had not been cleared properly. Like, they weren't cleared at all. You know, my second season is called Tunnel Vision, because that's what prosecutors and cops develop. It's called tunnel vision. When they lock in on somebody, they quit investigating anybody else. And they locked in on Adnan Syed, and that was it. That was it. It was done. So once they dug back in, and they had no idea themselves, the new prosecutors, Marilyn Mosby, had no idea about these people and their existence until they dug back in and did their own investigation. Once they found that, it was game on. They're like, holy shit.
It was notes that were in a desk, right, that she found?
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
So there were notes that were indicating that there were two other suspects. And
good suspects.
Good suspects that hadn't been fully vetted, like you said. It's just shocking to think about that. Like, you want to believe that if something happens to you or somebody you love, that the right person is going to get caught, they're going to be sent to jail, and then you don't have to worry about it. But this is just so shocking to hear that they had all of this written down and not thrown away.
And it happens all the time.
One of the suspects actually threatened Hayes' life in front of other people. And, like, where is he? We don't even know who that is this point. Like,
Marilyn Mosby said it best. Both of these guys had means, motive, and opportunity. And if you don't know what that means, listen to my podcast, because I explain it.
Isn't that the three things you need to convict someone?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, without those three things, a conviction is very, very hard to come by.
Because they didn't have that with Adnan, though.
They did not.
If you have a question, we do have a little stand here that you can come up to. We're recording it, so we would love for the audience to be able to hear you. Thank you.
Did you see the AG's response?
I did.
Where they were like, no, we handed this over. And what do you think about the fact that the state of Maryland, apparently there's a bit of an internal conflict between people that...
Jen, aren't you following me on Twitter?
Yes. I want you to talk about it for everybody.
For everybody else's benefit.
So essentially what happened is after the motion, I believe the AG's last name is Frosch, I want to say. The Attorney General of Maryland, who is also, he's the head prosecutor of the state. All right, so the Attorney General's office handles prosecution for the state. Like, say, for instance, if I were to come with any kind of constitutional claim in any of my state cases, I would have to refer it to the Attorney General because they handle any kind of constitutional claims like that. So as far as this motion gets filed, the judge rules obviously in favor of the prosecution, releases Adnan. unshackles him in the courtroom. Can you fucking imagine that?
The guy just
took his shackles off and he walked out. There's no processing him out of jail. Just walks out of the courthouse free after 23 years. I'd be like, I had goosebumps like reading live tweets about it. So it must have been stunning to be there. So at any rate, so the AG, you've got two prosecutors. You got a city prosecutor who's a much lower level prosecutor, and you got the attorney general basically butting heads. And the thing that's so beautiful about Marilyn Mosby is she doesn't give a shit. She does not give a shit. You know, because like her whole speech is, what I care about is justice. And it's always in my office, it's going to always be justice over convictions. The attorney general of the state of Maryland apparently feels like every other prosecutor in the country feels that, oh my God, this prosecutor just turned on her heels and shit all over her predecessors in this office and basically crossed the line and said, look, my predecessors committed Brady violations. That does not happen. I'm always the one in court saying, they didn't give us this, they didn't give it that. They never admit it. Because, like, as a defense attorney, I can't know if they didn't give me something if I don't know it exists. Mm-hmm. So you understand the way that it works. When the cops do the investigation, their entire investigation and all the reports go directly to the state's attorney. So the state's attorney is the filter by which all of the, like, all the documents, all the evidence goes through them. So if you've got a shady prosecutor that's picking out any kind of evidence that they feel is going to hurt their case and hinder their ability to be able to get a conviction on a case, it's mind blowing, and we won't know it exists. All right, so what I want to happen is I want criminal justice reform to happen. I want every prosecutor in the country to look at what happened on that case on Monday and say, my God, this is the right thing to do. You know, because it is. Because it's exactly like Melissa said, no one gets justice if they have the wrong guy in. No one. You know?
I would even say less people than the people originally involved.
But no one. No one is getting justice. Yeah. Like, no one involved got justice if the wrong man was convicted.
And then we have a killer walking the streets, and exactly. Who knows how many more he's committed. Mm-hmm.
One of these two mystery suspects is like currently in. Like, from what I understand, he's like incarcerated right now. I think other one's on the streets, but one of them's in. I don't know if it's a one or two guy thing. They might end up arresting two people on it.
This is pretty unprecedented.
It's crazy.
Yeah, like just to see something like this. I mean, you see wrongful convictions get overturned sometimes, but the speed at which it happened, and then just the sheer awareness of the national public about this case.
And it was by the prosecutor.
Yeah, that's the weirdest
it's
part.
It's never happened.
Yeah, like, that doesn't happen.
For as long as I've been practicing law, and like I'm pretty well, you know. I know quite a bit. I'm very old, so I know historically about, you know, just in terms of the criminal justice system. I am not familiar with this happening where there's just been an about face. And it's always the thing that bugs me the most. If you listen to my podcast, it's like, I just can't stand prosecutors that, you know, somewhat like, we're all human. We all make mistakes. It's okay. But what's not okay is for you to not realize and own up to the fact that you made a mistake and you convicted the wrong person and that person's sitting in prison. I mean, are you kidding me? You know, so like to me, the woman's heroic, and it's a damn shame because I think she lost her primary, Democratic primary in the election in July, and she's out in January, this, you know, Marilyn Mosby. So, you know, they'll probably put some piece of shit back in there, you know, but...
Tell us how you really feel, Bob.
Yeah, you know, I am a defense attorney at heart, so...
Bob can be brutally honest, but but you know that Bob's going to tell you the truth, whether you want to hear it or not, right? We need more Bob in the world. We do. We do. We need honesty, and I think that's so important, especially when we're talking about cases like this. Either of you have anything else you want to add before we move into our next topic? Okay, I want to open it up to questions. If you have questions about this, you can come up here and ask it or anything like that, or we can move on to the next one. Did you have a question? Oh, she's just enjoying her fries. Okay.
How are those fries? Are they crispy?
We really want to thank the Wanderlust Wine Company for hosting us this evening. This is an amazing space.
Cool spot.
Make sure you tip everybody really well and tell them how great the true crime community is, because we know you are. So we're going to talk about a fairly recent serial killer out of Fort Worth. And again, like I said, if you know who this is, if you know this story, let us know, and I don't know, we'll figure out. We'll give you a T-shirt.
Yay. Let's take some guesses. Throw some serial killers you'll know
from
DFW.
Texas in the
recent,
last year.
Last year. Anybody?
No?
Anybody?
You're not allowed.
Jeff, you're not allowed.
The name starts with a J. Does that help anybody?
First name starts with a J.
No?
All
right. Nothing.
Jason Allen Thornburg. Does that ring a bell?
No.
This is crazy.
Wow. This has never happened.
No.
Usually,
so 3 for 3.
Yeah. Well, we did a good job picking the case then.
Look at that.
So I'm going to start this off because, like I said in my introduction, I'm from New Mexico, and this case actually has ties into my home state, which is why we picked it, I think. Well, why I picked it. I don't know about you guys.
We just agreed with you.
You're like, Eric's going to steamroll us, so we're gonna do what he says.
We just smile and nod.
Yep.
Yes, Eric.
Sure, so whatever you want, Eric.
In 2017, there was a young woman named Tanya Begay who was in her mid-30s. She lived on the Navajo Reservation, or near the Navajo Reservation in Gallup, New Mexico. The Navajo Nation is a huge reservation. I think it might be the largest reservation in the U.S. It spans across 3 states. So it's New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah. And I think it's like 2,500 square miles.
Wow.
So it's gigantic. There's about 200,000 people who live on the Navajo Nation and who are registered as tribe members. If you're familiar at all with the missing and murdered indigenous women, it is a huge problem in our country. There are a lot of issues that go into why it's so difficult to prosecute these cases, why it's so difficult to charge people who are responsible for these cases. A lot of it has to do with jurisdictional issues. So, for example, in New Mexico, in Albuquerque is a city of about 1 million people, if you consider the metro area. But there are reservations on every side of the city. So on the south side, on the west side, on the north side. So the city cannot grow beyond that. But what happens is there's often issues where the county handles investigations of crime on this street, and the city handles it on this street, and the tribal police handle it on this part of the city. And so we also have the FBI who's involved. And this is all kind of convoluted, and I know it can be confusing, but this is why we have problems. Because if somebody goes missing and they're in kind of one of those gray areas, nobody wants to touch it. And so what we see a lot of times is that families will get ignored when they report their loved ones missing. So Tanya was dating a man named Jason Allen Thornburg. They decided to take a trip from Gallup into Arizona. And it was going to be a really nice vacation for the two, but Tanya never came back. She disappeared. And she still hasn't been seen since 2017. She was 36 years old. And prior to her disappearance, her boyfriend Jason had assaulted her with a glass coffee pot just a few days before. She called the cops and tried to file charges against him, but she later dropped them because she didn't, I don't know why. They were dropped because she failed to show up because she disappeared. Her best friend told Channel 12 News in Phoenix, quote, "I miss her like every day. You know, when you instantly feel and sense something, like I just knew my friend was gone forever. We automatically clicked. She was an amazing woman and loved her kids. She was needing a place to get away. She wasn't herself. Prior to her disappearing, I knew something was going on in her relationship, but she wouldn't go into detail. She was not safe. I could hear it in her voice. I knew in my heart, that she was never coming back. Reality really hit, or truly hit, sorry, when his story came out about the other 4 murders. I knew he killed Tanya."
So from 2017 all the way until May of 2021, we don't really know where Jason's at. But by the time 2021 comes around, he has a roommate. He's living in the Fort Worth area. His roommate's name is Mark Jewell. Mark was a 61-year-old religious man, very religious. And what initially everyone thought, Mark died in a gas explosion at their house, the house that Jason and Mark shared together. And because it was an explosion, the medical examiner really couldn't tell cause of death precisely. They just knew that the cause of death. So they didn't know the manner of death. They knew the cause of death was thermal and blast injuries. And it wouldn't be until months later when a bunch of other stuff happens that we'll get into. Jason ends up confessing that he was the one that actually murdered Mark. Jason went to Mark's funeral because they were roommates, they were friends. He gets up and speaks in front of everyone. It was a small funeral, but still the fact that he knew exactly what happened to Mark, he gets up in front of all of his friends and family and states, Mark was such a good friend to me. We loved to Bible study together. He taught me a lot, all while knowing exactly what happened to Mark.
Which was murder.
So after this house fire, obviously Jason has been forced into homelessness, essentially.
Yes.
He needed a place to live, had to find solace somewhere. He made his way to a motel, the Mid-City Inn in Euless, Texas. He would be seen in the area reading his Bible, reaching out to people, kind of witnessing to the community. He passed out flyers all over the Fort Worth area, claiming to have an encyclopedic level of understanding of the Bible. He thought he knew every word of that book, forwards, backwards, and upside down.
And I want to add, so we had Vincent from Gone Cold in Fort Worth for this first round. And he's actually friends with somebody who was really good friends with Mark Jewell. And Vince really feels strongly that he may have had a remedial understanding of the Bible according to people from the church that he was a part of. So this is kind of like, I don't know if I stole your thunder on that, but it is undermining his own belief of how great he is.
Correct.
Sorry, I wanted to also say that it was almost as if Jason wanted to be Mark. Mark was this very religious man, really well known for his religious work. And it was almost as if he wanted to emulate Mark. And that could be a possible motive for why he murdered him, allegedly.
Allegedly. And while Jason is passing out these flyers, meeting all these people, he's inviting them back to his motel room to have Bible studies and to celebrate the Word of God and really just congregate with all of these people at his motel room. Now, the type of people that he was reaching out to that kind of hung out in the area, it wasn't the highest, I don't know, what's the word?
He wasn't going after fellow church members. He was
Correct.
Finding people who were vulnerable and who were looking for help.
Mm-hmm. And giving them an opportunity to study the word with him. Now, shift gears here a little bit. On September 22nd, 2021, the Fort Worth Fire Department is called out to a dumpster fire at 6:17 a.m. It's at 3210 Bonnie Drive near a church. And they get there, they put the fire out, and they realize at the bottom of this dumpster, there's something in there. It first appears to be two bodies, mutilated, dismembered, and the fire department said, whoa, 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 we need police. This is over our pay grade. Someone else needs to come out for this. Once medical investigators arrive, they actually find that there is the remains of at least three bodies inside this dumpster.
And so when the cops arrived at the scene, the Fort Worth chief of police is quoted as saying about that crime scene that it was absolutely horrific. And that this is a quote that it's the type of crime scene that no one, law enforcement, no one should ever have to be exposed to. It was that gruesome. Essentially what they find are people that have been
dismembered and then set ablaze. So, I mean, you can imagine. I couldn't personally stomach even looking at it. So you can just imagine how horrific that crime scene was. But as we are prone to do, all three of our podcasts, we want to talk about the victims here because they're really the ones who matter in the story. So they were actually able to identify these folks in relatively short order. It didn't take very long for them to put two and two together with respect to, and a lot of it goes back to, I don't want to jump ahead in the story, but they kind of figure out where Thornburg was and where he was staying and where he was located. That helps them in very short order figure out who these folks were. So the first victim that they're able to identify was a 42-year-old male named David Lueres, and he had lived on and off in North Texas for the past 25 years. Now, I don't want this to be construed as victim blaming, and because it's not. But the reality is that every single person in this room and every single person on this planet is a human being, and every single one of us is flawed. There is no such thing as a perfect victim. To go around and shit on people because they may have been arrested once when they were 17 or 20, or because they're addicted to drugs, or because they have mental... None of that matters.
Or they're sex workers.
Whatever the case is. Like anybody who's been murdered is an absolute victim who did not deserve to be murdered. I don't care what they did in any point in their life. So David had struggled mightily throughout the last 25 years. He had a cousin who had been tracked down by the media who said that as far as she had known that David had been basically trying to run away from somebody that was either stalking her or harassing him back in Arizona. So he's basically on the run from whoever this person is. They didn't articulate who it was. But what we do know is that he was struggling with addiction. He had a methamphetamine addiction, which we can probably blame the pharmaceutical companies, but that's an entirely different podcast. But, you know, so he's battling his own demons. He's trying to battle this addiction, and he's also battling mental illness, which go hand in hand. If, you know, because of the state of our country, a lot of people that maybe not are in a position to go to the doctor to get prescriptions self-medicate. And what they use for that is they use street drugs to make themselves feel better, to make them, you know, make themselves feel better mentally. So that's the battle that this guy is going in. And Thornburg is looking at these people that he's victimizing and seeing exactly what their state is. And he sees that they're susceptible and that they're looking for answers and they're looking for help and they're looking for companionship and they're looking for conversation. All those things that made these people perfect victims for him to be able to draw into his lair. So 42-year-old David Lueres is the first guy that they're able to identify. And what we know about his untimely demise is that on the 17th of September of this year, no, I'm sorry, nope. Of last year, he's talked into coming into the hotel, into the room. Now, the Mid-City Inn, I want
motel.
Yeah, it's a motel.
Motel.
So, like, I want you to understand that you guys know what the difference between a hotel and a motel is, right? So we were just having the discussion last night about, like, whether you have the ability to picture things in your mind when you close your eyes. So imagine, like, seedy motel, two stories, long building.
All the doors open on the exterior of the building.
Exactly. You know, like, everyone's kind of hanging out on the balcony. A lot of drug users, a lot of addicts around the area. So it's a rough spot, all right? But Thornburg has made it a point to kind of make that his home base, and that's where he's conducting his Bible study groups, to get right with the Lord, right? That's what he's doing. So, yeah, well, that's what he's doing. So he talks David Lueres into coming into his room. In very short order, he slits his throat and proceeds to dismember him in his bathtub. He keeps him in the bathtub until he procures some trash bags, at which time he takes the dismembered body parts, puts them in the trash bag, and then he had bought bins, big Rubbermaid bins that he put the entire dismembered body in, and then he stores that. Okay. And then 2 days later, on the 19th, a young woman, 34-year-old young woman named Lauren Phillips, who was an only child, who had been adopted, who was the mother. Oh, no, I take that back. She wasn't the adopted one. She was the daughter of a lady named Kathy Phillips. Lauren was a mother of two sons. Much like David, she was having a hard time in life. She had lost custody of her two boys, and she was struggling with addiction, with mental illness. It had gotten to the point, I had read an article that her mother had said that she had had to resort to tough love. Said, I can't do it with you anymore. You've got to go help yourself. So, again, we have Thornburg preying on somebody whose family has gotten to the point where they said, look, I love you, but we can't do it anymore. You know, you're gonna have to try to figure this out on your own. Unfortunately, that makes her incredibly vulnerable, which ultimately she gets caught within Thornburg's, web. And she is, again, invited into the hotel under the premise that they're going to be doing Bible study and they're going to be talking about, you know, how Jesus can save them and, you know, all those things that draw people in when they're looking for answers. And she ultimately has a knife fight with Thornburg. He tries to stab her. She fights back. She puts up a hell of a fight. He's ultimately able to overtake her physically and ends up strangling her. He strangles her to death. Again, he dismembers the body, places it in plastic garbage bags, and then into the Rubbermaid bins. So at this point, on the 21st, we've got two victims in the hotel room in Rubbermaid bins. The third victim is another woman named Mata Cruz Reyes Mathis. Now, she was adopted, and she was adopted by a couple named May and Cecil Hanshaw. She had a sister, and she also was a mother to a sweet little girl. She also did not have custody, as her adopted parents actually had custody of her daughter at that point. But again, she's same MO. She's battling addiction. She's battling mental illness. You know, she's lost at that point. She just needs help, and she needs to, you know, unfortunately rely on somebody to help her battle through this. And she happens to pick probably the worst person that you could possibly pick to have her try to see her way through it. So ultimately, again, she arrives at the hotel, and again, and I'm not, I'm going to let Eric or one of the girls get into what he was doing, like what the premise of what he was doing is. But again, she's stabbed to death, dismembered, stuffed into a garbage bag in a Rubbermaid container. So at this point, from the 17th through the 21st, so where there's 2 days between each murder, he's murdered three people over a six-day period. Is that 6 days or 5 days? So over a very, very short period, this guy's busy. This guy's lost control of whatever faculties he has in terms of being able to control his compulsions. And he's just, you know, it's gotten to the point where somebody's got to stop him. So
yeah.
That's where we're going to get to how they stopped him in very, yeah. very short order.
So fire department came out. There's the dumpster fire with the body parts inside of it. Police immediately start investigating, and one of the first things they do is they start to ask for surveillance footage immediately surrounding the area of the dumpster. On surveillance, police noted a dark-colored SUV stopped by the dumpster at about 10:50 p.m. the night before the fire. A male stepped out of the driver's seat and then made multiple trips carrying what appeared to be large Rubbermaid containers to the dumpster from the SUV. He loaded the containers and then left minutes later. At 5 a.m. on the 22nd of September 2021, the SUV returned to the dumpster again and starts unloading more containers from the SUV and placing them in the dumpster. He is finally seen placing a single item in the dumpster, turns his vehicle around, and then goes back to the dumpster to light it on fire.
So after police had this initial surveillance where they kind of could tell the type of vehicle it was, they started branching out. They kind of followed that vehicle with surveillance to see if they could get a better picture of it to narrow it down. They ended up figuring out that this was a Jeep Cherokee around the years 2005 to 2010, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it had some chrome accents. So we're getting detailed now. They also were able to verify that this had temporary plates or temporary tags, which also narrowed down their search. So then they pull all of the records for everyone in that area that happened to have this type of vehicle. It's a long list. I mean, a few hundred people are on this. One detective actually remembered Jason Thornburg's name from months prior when his house exploded, and that I don't necessarily know he was a suspect, but obviously it's in the same area. Oh, here's a fire that's looking very suspicious. So I believe that they took his name first, kind of ran with it, figured out if they could narrow it down that way.
Absolutely. So at this point, they're thinking, is there an arson connection here? Because we've got two fires, and now we've got more bodies. We had a body in the house. We have bodies in the dumpster. So how do we get a hold of this Jason? They contacted the lien holder on his vehicle, which thankfully this specific lien holder had a GPS tracker on that vehicle, and they were able to pull the history of where he has been. Now, probably a long list because people drive all the time, but they noticed that there was one address that repeatedly came up on this GPS history, and it happened to be the address of the Mid-City Inn. So they thought, hey, he must frequent here at the very least, or live here at the very least, girlfriend lives there, something. They're able to go and meet him at this location. They did get up to the lobby, and they learned that room 113 was registered in Jason's name and that he had been staying there since July 28th of 2021. They were able to ask the office manager there if they had any surveillance on the property, and lo and behold, we got lucky in 2021, and they had surveillance footage that they kept and they held on to, and they could actually view it. And they watched this footage, and they saw Jason carrying several large containers from his room of 113, place it in his Jeep while he was wearing a full-body Tyvek suit. And I feel this is important because thought has to go into putting that on. Is that to preserve evidence? Is that to make sure that his clothes stay clean, that none of his hair or DNA gets from his body to these containers? Thought had to go through his mind to put this suit on. He leaves the motel at 10:24 p.m. and then returns and leaves it for a second load of containers and leaves again at 12:26 a.m.
I did just have a thought. I am sure they went back in that surveillance, and that is how they are able to tell which day those particular victims went inside his room but never came out.
Exactly, because it was two of them were staying at the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was how they were able to put that together. Do you have more?
I don't know what's happening. Okay, I fixed it. Sorry.
Oh, did you fix it? Are we to me? Are
you're
you still, you're still going?
Nope, you're good.
You're next.
Okay, so... So what they have at this point is they've got the Jeep, all right? They know the Jeep, but what they don't have is a 100% identification of who is driving the Jeep. They know who owns it, aside from the lien owner. So they know Thornburg is the owner in terms of he is the person who has purchased the car. That does not necessarily mean that he is the murderer.
Right.
Yes.
So... At this point, they're like, okay, we're gonna track this guy, and we're gonna track this vehicle, okay, which is what they do. So they're sitting on the motel, and they start following him around. And at that point, they follow him to Arlington, and he's working in Arlington, and he's got a residence that he goes to. I don't know if it's a friend, but there's a house that he goes to there. And ultimately, they find him coming out of work. And at this point, they don't have the probable cause either on Jewel or the three victims, okay? So they don't have probable cause. They don't have a warrant. But they approach him and they say, hey, you know, we'd like to ask you some questions. Would you come into to the station with us and talk with us? And he says, sure, I will.
And Bob, can you explain how they are allowed to pull that GPS and have that knowledge?
Yeah. It's
legally?
So, and we talked about this last night, and it's something I don't know if you guys are aware of, but in terms of kind of like how the law enforcement agencies can access all of our data in terms of our electronic data, whether it be cell phone records, bank records, GPS locations, they don't need a warrant. Okay, all they need is a subpoena. Now, I've got a problem with that. I'm a big civil liberties guy. I don't like that the government can track us, and I don't like that they can get into our business without a warrant, because it should always be the level where they have probable cause to believe that you've committed a crime in order for them to be able to dig into our private information. So what the Fourth Amendment requires in terms of law enforcement is if we have what's called a reasonable expectation of privacy, they cannot search us. They cannot search our homes. They cannot search our persons. They cannot search our vehicles if we have that expectation of privacy. So, for instance, if you guys, when you bring your garbage out to your front curb, if you guys do that out here in Texas, that's free game, because you have given up any kind of reasonable expectation of privacy. So what the state and the government have really done with respect to the law is they have determined that because there's third parties involved that handle our cell phone bills and our records and our banking records, that we have given up our expectation of privacy because somebody else has access to them. Now, I'm sure you guys, if you're of the same mindset, that's bullshit. I don't want anybody digging around my banking records, and I don't want anybody digging around my phone records, but the Supreme Court has held that that is allowable. So at this point in our country, just so you guys know, and I'm sure you guys aren't out there committing crimes, but if you are, just know they don't have to have probable cause to dig into your banking records and your phone records, okay?
So that's so use how they, cash, yeah, is what Bob's saying.
And your, yeah, I mean, so.
And don't use the internet.
Yes, don't ever use the internet. Get off the grid. We all need to get off the grid. So that's how they were able to do this without having a warrant.
Or also don't commit crimes. I mean, that's also
That could be the option, too.
That's what we recommend.
I mean, that is the best recommendation out of all of them. Just don't commit the crimes.
Don't murder people, please.
So they end up, they get them into the station. At this point, and remember, guys, this is an active case. This case has not gone to trial. So when we're done, if you try Googling whatever happened to Jason Allen Thornburg, it's pending, okay? So he has not gone to trial yet. So at this point, they bring him in. So I don't know if he had a lawyer or not. I'm assuming he did not. I'm assuming he did not lawyer up and say, I want to speak to a lawyer. And I don't know whether he was read his Miranda rights or not either, because we haven't seen the discovery, and it hasn't gotten that far into the case to where we'll know that type of information pursuant to motions that have been filed. So whatever the case may be, they go in and they say, hey, we want to ask you some questions about this dumpster fire that we found. And this guy ultimately ends up spilling his guts in very, very short order. And what comes to light, and we're going to touch upon kind of the strategy of the defense that kind of forms, and I think Melissa's got some long thoughts on whether or not it's bullshit. But, you know, he says, because he's trying to get right with the Lord, that he's committing these sacrifices because he's had a calling from God, and that in order for him to get to where he needs to be, that God has told him he has to commit these sacrifices, perform these sacrifices in order for him to get to the promised land. And so he starts confessing to all of the murders. He confesses to all three of the murders that he committed in the hotel. He also confesses to killing Jewel at the house, and he goes into detail. So as Melissa had told you, it was originally thought that he was killed from the explosion itself. It was really, he was the first sacrifice. He had been sacrificed, he had been stabbed. In order to cover it up, he blew the house up. And he did that by uncapping the gas line and then lighting a candle and happened to stroll out of the house. Probably 20 minutes later, when the house filled up with gas, it blew up. And it was effective. I mean, I don't know that they would have been able to prove that had he not confessed it. So in that sense, I guess we're fortunate in order to be able to hang that murder on him. He then confesses to killing his girlfriend.
Tanya,
back in 2017, I believe it was,
yes.
Correct?
Yep.
So there was a long gap. I'm not so sure that this guy wasn't killing in between, you know, to be honest with you.
Like, I believe they're currently searching for other cases that may fit this MO.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem to be likely.
But why wouldn't he confess to those other ones? If he's going to confess to Tanya's and Mark's, why wouldn't he just say all of them? Especially because Tanya has never been found.
I think that at that point, he realized that and we're going to get into a theoretical conversation up here in a minute, but I think that he thought his best approach was going to be the insanity defense. You know, I mean, anybody that's committing crimes of this nature that has some wherewithal of the criminal justice system, and this guy had been in and out of the system. Like, he had a rap sheet. This was not the first time he had been picked up. Obviously, it was the first time of anything of this magnitude, but, you know, he was not unfamiliar with the criminal justice system. Most people are not unfamiliar with the insanity defense. So, you know, he goes with this story that God's talking to him. God's telling me that I have to do these things, and that's why I did it. And I did it with these three, and I did it with Jewel, and I did it with Begay as well. So, you know, that's where I'm at. And, you know, and I believe this, and I'm willing to own up to this because I feel like this is my ticket to heaven. So I'm going to tell you because it's what I was supposed to be doing. So that was his play all along. So at that point, obviously, they indict him originally on the three murders. And then shortly thereafter, he's indicted on Jewel. And then after that, he's indicted on Begay's murder as well. So at that point, and theoretically, you've got three separate trials.
I don't think he's been indicted on Begay's yet. They haven't found her body. They don't know where she is. And I think they're waiting to see what happens with that.
I thought I read something that recently they did, but maybe I didn't. I don't know.
It's possible that it happened recently. But up until, I think, a couple weeks ago, there was still no progress on that case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not unusual for the state not to want to proceed without a body. I mean, they've done it many times, but it's not preferable. But when you have a full confession from somebody,
makes it easier.
It's easier for sure. But, you know, obviously their preference would be to have the remains and to be able to perform an autopsy and things of that nature. So we're at the point now and I believe this happened in February, correct? Does that sound right in terms of him being indicted?
Yeah, I think it was around February.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, of this year,
2022. And so he's in front of the judge, and they have a hearing, and the judge, on her own motion, which judges can do, is she found that there was enough, what she called reasonable cause, not probable cause. She called it, there's reasonable cause to believe that he had a mental defect or a serious mental disorder, and that she ordered a full mental psych eval to be done in very short order. She wanted it done in 4 days. So as we sit here today, none of us know what that evaluation came back as, but we have to assume that they found that he's not normal. You know, whether or not, and this is where we kind of get into the insanity defense, and I don't know, and this is where we kind of want some participation from you guys. You know, because there's a difference between medical insanity and legal insanity. They're vastly different things. Legal insanity is defined as not having the ability to comport your behavior to the requirements of the law, meaning that I knew it was wrong. I know right from wrong, because that used to be the way it was back in the day. They called it the McNaughton rule, that the person didn't know right from wrong, that they were banging their heads on the wall, frothing at the mouths, that kind of crazy person. You know, it's not the case anymore. Now it's somebody who has a compulsion who's incapable physically and mentally incapable of being able to control themselves from committing these murders. What do you guys think about that as a defense? Do you guys think you buy in that ever if you're on a jury?
Come to the microphone and talk to us.
Jeff, come on up.
I would like to know, is there any precedent for, like, religion, God made me do it?
Oh, yeah.
Like religious freedoms?
Well, as it pertains to a crime.
You mean, has that been used as a defense?
Absolutely. It's obviously come up before, like, God asked me to commit this crime. What's the precedent for that?
Well, I mean, it depends. Like, from the lawyer's perspective, and we had this discussion last night, I don't necessarily care what his motive was in terms of whatever was going on in his mind, whether it be a God theory, whether it be, you know, like Gacy, you know, he always was saying that these people were always coming back to blackmail him and out him, you know, with the fact that he was gay, you know, so that, or they were asking for money, you know, so that he was forced to kill them. You know, whatever the theory was, from the lawyer's side of it, we don't really care. What we care about is getting them evaluated and letting the professionals vet whether or not they're malingering, whether or not they're lying, in order to be able to sustain that insanity plea or that insanity defense. So, yes, I mean, to answer your question, religion has been used many, many times in terms of people's motives for why they've done things, you know.
So, is that an effective strategy to get lower sentencing?
No, it's not. It's really not. I mean, the insanity defense is incredibly hard to convince people of on a jury. Incredibly hard. Because exactly what the girls are both going to start saying. They're going to say, well, you know, I mean, the guy was avoiding the crimes. He was wearing a Tyvek suit. I mean, he's trying not to leave DNA. He's doing everything to avoid capture. You know, he's disposing of the bodies. He's burning the body. Like, all those things show premeditation. You know, they seem to show a rational mind. But there's a distinction that, like, that's what I'm saying. You don't have to be the frothing at the mouth, I can't put thoughts together guy. You can be able to avoid the police and still have a compulsion to kill that you cannot control.
Yeah.
So,
bringing up the whole premeditation, it looks like he had to get a knife. He had to get these Rubbermaid totes.
The trash bags.
Trash bags. This seems, in my mind, up until last night, I'm like, he knew what he was doing all the way up, all the way. But then Bob brought up some points about
compelling arguments.
He did, you know, that it is a compulsion, that he knows it's wrong, but he cannot control himself. I still lean towards this side.
Well,
that
what happens if he truly, truly believes that God is speaking to him and that God is telling him to do this? Doesn't that make him insane? I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I haven't had God talking to me recently, telling me to do shit, let alone murder anybody. You know, so I mean, it's a very tough question because we all want to hold people responsible for their actions. And that's the battle for defense attorneys in these types of cases, is because you've got 12 people on a jury that are sitting there looking at this weirdo sitting there that's done things that are beyond imagination that no normal person would ever be capable of doing. Yet you've got innocent people who lost their lives, and they want to hold someone accountable. And when they know who the guy is, they know it's him. He's confessed to it. It's a very, very, very hard battle to win, to convince jurors to say, man, you know, as much as I don't want to do it, I have to admit that the guy, more likely than not, is insane, you know, and he couldn't control his compulsion. So it's a very difficult, it really, and I talk about it in my pod, it's the last resort defense. Like, no criminal defense attorney wants to have to employ it, because it's different, and we just know so little about the human brain. We really do.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, you know, they're doing MRIs. If they don't see anything definitive in terms of, you know, masses in there, or, you know, large dark areas where there could be something going on, you know, it's like the human mind is a mystery to all of us still, and that includes the professionals. So, I don't know. It's a tough defense, but I think it's it's a real defense. I don't think it's a bullshit defense. I think there are people out there that are broken, that aren't like the rest of us, that cannot control themselves. And I think that's a real thing. And the question then becomes, as a society, do we acknowledge that? Do we want to try to maybe learn from them by having them hospitalized? Because with Gacy, that case, there's no one that could think that that guy was normal. Okay, no normal human being is burying and living for years, over 27 bodies, a graveyard in his house, and think that that's normal. That's just not normal. So, and with that, there was no, there in the DSM, there was no category for him that fit. Nothing. So when they hired Richard Rappaport, who was the psychiatrist, the forensic psychiatrist that they hired, he, in that case, came up with the borderline personality disorder because he didn't fit into any category cleanly, but he was broken. There was something that was broken about him, that he could not control his behavior to what we expect out of people in this criminal justice system. So I don't know.
I did look up. So he has not been indicted on Tanya's murder. The news that was covering this case did reach out to the Navajo Nation police to ask them for an update on charges, and they did not reply to the news.
Now, Eric, you is a New Mexican. Do you guys go by New Mexican?
New Mexican.
Okay, so
yeah,
and you guys have a very large indigenous population there, correct?
We have 21 tribes in our state.
So, in terms of jurisdiction, how does that work?
Like, it doesn't. It doesn't work. I was alluding to it earlier. So there's a part of Albuquerque on the west side, and the locals call it Tohajali, but it's Tohaile, which is probably the most native word I've ever said. Tohaile is right on the border of Bernalillo County, Albuquerque City, and the Laguna tribe. And so there was a woman who was murdered and found kind of in the gray area between all of those jurisdictions, and literally nobody touched it. And she's just, nothing's happening. There's no investigation. Her family's looking for answers, but because she was a Native woman, because she had substance abuse issues of her own, because she ran in circles with people who were involved in sex work and drug trafficking, her life was not considered to be worth looking into or investigating. And again, it comes into those jurisdictional issues of, I don't want to step on their toes, they don't want to step on my toes, we don't want to step on anybody else's toes, and the victims are the ones that lose in that scenario.
And resources. It's like, hey, we're not going to use our money.
Right.
That's outside our area.
And tribal police are underfunded, undertrained, and under-resourced.
And isn't it true, I don't even think that the feds have the ability to go on to a reservation, correct?
They can press charges for murder and for capital crimes on the reservation, but it is tricky because of the sovereignty of the tribe. The tribe should be able to be sovereign and to govern themselves. And so the U.S. government doesn't want to get involved because that creates problems. There are treaties between the tribes and the U.S. government that can't be overrun. So I know you are going to talk about something. I'm going to turn it over to you, and then we're going to go into a little bit of a palate cleanser because this was a little heavy, but let's you do that.
So let's talk a little bit about why you may have not heard about this case. There is obvious reasons as to why missing and murdered Indigenous women are not covered as much, whether it's a jurisdictional issue, whether it's they just don't get the coverage that they need. No one wants to talk about it because it's a taboo subject, it seems. So with the name Jason Allen Thornburg, how would you picture this man? Guess just say it out. It's fine.
Throw it out there.
Race?
Race.
Yes. Explain what
anybody
you think.
Have a guess on his race. White?
What is most serial killers?
White? Does everybody agree
white
that they think
males.
He's white? Yeah?
Yeah.
Especially with a name like Jason Allen Thornburg.
He's actually Dene.
Navajo.
He's actually Navajo.
He's Navajo.
Yeah, he's Dene. So that might be a reason.
So could that be a reason that it hasn't been covered? Potentially.
Could be.
I mean, I never heard of the case until I got down to Texas, and they're like, this is the case we're doing. never heard of it. The guy killed five people, you know? I mean,
I heard about it as my few years that I lived in Texas, which I just moved in January back to Florida, I had actually heard of this case as it was happening. As soon as the bodies were discovered in the dumpster, I like sent it to Whitney within minutes. And so that's why I was shocked that nobody had heard of it. I did live right outside of Dallas at that time, so maybe that's why. Except for all of our Fort Worth people did not know, and all of our Dallas people did not know.
And the Fort Worth people were like, oh yeah, I went to that church, or like that house, that motel's right behind my house. Like, how did they not know?
Not a clue.
It's crazy.
It's in your neighborhood. It's bizarre.
They're like, oh my gosh, my grandma lives on that road.
Yeah.
So all right. Listen, before we jump into that, there's a moral to this story, folks.
Go ahead.
And the moral of the story is, don't go into a hotel or motel room with a strange man to do Bible study. Okay? Yeah. Don't do it.
But that doesn't mean that it was the victim's fault that they died.
That is 100%.
Okay.
But just as a general rule, don't do that.
Don't do it. Okay, so you guys ready for a palate cleanser? That was a little heavy.
It's a lot.
A little icky. All right.
Murdery.
So have you heard of Florida man? Yeah? Yeah? We're going to do Texas person because we want to be inclusive in our language.
Sure.
Texas person. So this is actually Texas man. On Monday, April 17th, 2017, at about 11:50 a.m. in Houston, Texas, a man walks into a Latino cellular store. That is the name of the store. He walks in, and there's a couple people in the lobby. There's somebody working behind the counter. He goes behind the counter, and he asks, not so politely, for the person working to give them all of their money. And the woman, who is a Latina, proud Latinas. First of all, you never tell a Latina to do anything. If you value your life, you don't do it. Okay? So she immediately is like, no.
Not doing
She's just like, no.
But wait,
not giving you my money.
You missed out that there is video of this.
You can YouTube it. Yeah. You can hear her telling him no. And he's like, I'm serious. Give me your money. She's like, no. And so he's just standing there like, what do I do? And she walks around him, goes out into the lobby, and ushers everybody outside. They all go outside, and they lock him in. And so now he's locked in this store. And this is a Latino cellular, so there are bars on the windows. There are bars on the doors. The glass is probably bulletproof, right? Yeah. I mean, I think we figured that out.
Yeah.
So he starts panicking, and you see him like walking back and forth. He's like, oh my God, what do I do? Oh shit. And like, you know, he starts praying.
Yes.
He's like, you know, God, help me get out of here. God's like, bro, you did that to yourself. Like, good luck. He starts to kick the door. He starts running at the door, trying to break it with his shoulder. He takes out his .22 pistol, starts shooting at the door. Nothing happens. He cannot get out. And then he starts begging the women that are out there, like, please let me out. Please, I'm sorry. Oh, my God, let me out. He gets arrested. He goes to jail. Real stupid.
Not a great crime.
YouTube the video. It's hilarious. It's worth the watch. It's about 6 minutes long.
Yeah, it's
you
good.
Liked it? You saw it? It's really funny, right? Yeah.
My favorite part is that he had taken stuff off the shelf,
and
he's like hitting the door to get out, and he's like, oh, maybe if I put this back, they'll let me out. So he goes and puts it back on the shelf, and then he's like, please let me out. I didn't take anything. Help.
Just kidding.
That was the best. That was the best part.
I mean, it was really, really quick thinking on her part because she got those people out, and there was a woman with a stroller.
Look, Latinas don't play. He's lucky he didn't get stabbed. That's all I'm saying.
For real.
She's walking out. She just takes her head to his throat.
Yeah, definitely. So that is my Texas man story.
So I'll do mine. Melissa and I met in the North Texas town of Wichita Falls. My husband and I lived there for 12 years. We got to Austin as quick as we could, basically. And this one made national news, so I'm pretty sure you guys have probably heard of it. A lady took out
I feel like that's a strong word. Maybe a woman.
A woman took a joyride in an electric cart through Walmart while drinking her favorite Cabernet from a Pringles can.
As you do.
As you do. For three...
I mean, we've all done it. We've all done it.
For 3 hours, she's cruising Walmart. Now, I don't know if y'all have ever had to use one of those electric carts. When I was in high school, I'd have knee surgery and had to use one for a period of time. I've never seen one that would last for 3 hours. So I don't know if she got the new one that week or if she stopped and plugged in for a minute.
The supercharged rascal.
Yeah, she had the good one that time. But then, it had to have been, right?
She's got one of those Elon Musk batteries.
Police get called after they realize she's drinking from a Pringles can, and she's been here a while with not really purchasing anything. She's taking her joyride outside now. Police have arrived, and a chase ensues. Now,
a low-speed chase.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know if it's on foot or on electric cart, but if it was on electric cart, then I feel really bad for the police department that they weren't able to catch her.
Yeah, but doesn't speak well to them, right?
Well, but, she has to be drunk by this point as well.
Well, I mean, I think we realize through this and through various social media memes at this point that a Pringles can will hold a full bottle of wine.
Yes. Oh, yeah, baby.
So if you need a measurement...
Pro tip.
We are now taking our bottles by Pringle can. We've had 4 Pringle cans worth of wine this evening. That's our new measurement.
That's a life hack that you can take with you to the Walmart parking lot.
I mean,
you could, but you have to remember that they're made of paper, so it can't last very long in there. And
I mean,
also, like, floaties.
It's got a pretty good seal, right?
Yeah. 3 hours. It'll last 3 hours, apparently.
Yeah, this shit was definitely leaking at that point. She's like, I'm out.
Yeah.
There would have to be like chunks of chips as well.
Mm. It's like a salty sweet situation, you know? We're assuming that she enjoyed the Pringles prior to the wine, but it's definitely never really been reported one way or the other.
Yes.
She did get very lucky that her name has never been released.
She is banned, though, from that Walmart.
And
forever.
I mean, did you know that's even a possibility?
Are you sure?
The way you said that makes me think it might be.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you brought it up is making me think that maybe it was your mom.
Right, we'll never tell.
My Texas man story happens right here in Austin at everyone's favorite grocery store, H-E-B. Apparently, a man, this was in 2015, goes into H-E-B, and he comes out with steals $2,000 worth of brisket.
Ooh, a lot of meat.
Yeah. This was 2015, so obviously meat was probably a third of
reasonable,
the cost now.
Priced.
So that's a lot. I mean, I don't know. Can you carry $2,000 worth of
apparently,
brisket?
Yeah. I mean, it had to have been like a pants load. Like, he had to have stuffed
or
it in his pants. Because I don't think you can carry that much.
I don't know how logistic.
It was like Dan Aykroyd in Trading Places when he's shoving the salmon in his Santa outfit. I mean, you know,
so
if there's a will, there's a way.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So he ended up taking this meat, and he would sell it to local barbecue restaurants.
Hey.
We don't know if it was Terry Black's, but
profit
we recommend
time.
Asking where they source it.
Yes. I'm like, excuse me, where did you get this meat?
$2,000. And Lainey had a pretty good one. Our fellow podcaster had a pretty good one last night. It was very briefly. It was a gal who went into a funeral and decided to creep up on the casket,
the deceased,
and proceed to steal a $1,800 necklace off the corpse during a funeral. So that's a nice Texas woman story for you. Mine's a little bit different. I find mine to be a touching tale. Actually, it takes place in the beautiful burg of Port Arthur, Texas. On April's Day of 2021, and a wonderful gentleman was walking by a residence with a nice little white picket fence, and he happens to see that there's a lawnmower in the yard. He's like, you know what? I could use a lawnmower. So decides to climb over the fence, and I think his plan is going to be to steal the lawnmower, right? He's going to take the lawnmower. However, this entire affair is caught on surveillance. Okay, and what actually ends up happening is he gets the lawnmower, he proceeds to try to start it, finds out it's out of gas, goes and gets a red gas can that's sitting at the yard, fills it up with gas, proceeds to mow both the front and back lawn for these fine folks.
What a nice
How
guy.
Kind.
What a guy.
So
what
stupid.
A guy.
That's Southern hospitality.
Then he steals the lawnmower, makes it about halfway down the alley, decides it's too damn heavy, and abandons the mower.
Did we say it's not a rider mower?
It's It's a push.
It's a push mower.
It is a push mower.
Yeah.
At this point, he's still on the loose. So if you're lucky, if you leave your lawnmower out, maybe, just maybe, and you're not a big fan of mowing your lawn, maybe this guy
he'll come to
come
it for
and
you.
Take care of your business.
It's like the lawn fairy. Instead of they'll mow your lawn, but then instead of taking the tooth, they take the lawnmower.
The lawnmower.
It's like the person that steals something from you and then helps you look for it.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a treasure.
Where
hunt.
Did it go?
Yeah,
weird.
Scavenger hunt.
It's so weird that I suddenly have this necklace off that your dead aunt. Yeah. I don't know.
Twinsies.
So this is the interactive part of the night. Hopefully that helped kind of clear the air, the energy for you, so you're not feeling so down.
I did have
another story that I just want to kind of highlight, that there was a woman who fell for a prank that the police did, where they said that there had been reports of Ebola-contaminated meth. And to be extra safe, people should bring their meth to have it tested to make sure that it doesn't have Ebola.
They were going
to
do it for free.
Bring it to the police station. I mean, have your meth tested, folks.
It's a deal.
It's a deal. They were doing it for free. Do you know how much
free
Ebola
testing
test
on your meth.
And so this woman, who I assume probably had been using some of her product, was concerned that there may be Ebola in it, so she took it to the police station.
I hope I didn't get that Ebola strain meth.
And she got arrested.
Oh. Mm, yeah.
Nobody saw that coming.
You know, Mom
Nobody.
Always said, stupid is, stupid does.
So if you have questions for us, either about what we covered this evening or about our shows, or if you just want to talk
Burning
to us.
True crime questions. Now
well,
is the opportunity to come
I mean,
ask
if you want to know what the weather is tomorrow, I've got an app.
Yeah, we can do that.
I'll answer
if we're in Texas, I'm guessing
got.
Hot. Very, very hot.
But yeah, if you have questions, if not, what we'll do is we'll do a little meet and greet. We'll hang out. We'll have some wine with you. You can take some pictures with us. If you can prove to me that you are subscribed to True Consequences, I will give you a free T-shirt tonight.
Woo! What a guy.
So
what
if you're
guy,
not subscribed, you can subscribe now before I look at your phone and still get a free T-shirt. So
T-R-U-E-C-O-N.
S-E-Q-U-E-N-C-E-S.
Yeah.
All right, we love you guys. Thank you so much for coming out.
It's hang out with us. Take some pictures.
Yeah, hang, drink. We'll talk. We'll shoot the shit. Have some fun. So no questions, no burning true crime questions.
Last call.
Last call for alcohol. Last call for alcohol. All right, good. We're done talking.
Let's hang
Wait,
out.
Jeff has a question.
Oh. Jeff, go.
As if he can't ask his wife at any moment. He has to come forward right now.
Jeff is Whitney's
This is my husband.
I am. Well, if you had to have somebody listen to one of your podcast episodes, which one would it be?
Oh, gosh. You guys go first because I got to think about it.
Yeah, mine's easy. Start at number one of season one. Mine's serialized. Well, Eric's got a full serialized season, but he does a lot of one-offs. So he's got some episodes. He's primarily episodic, so he's going to have to really do some heavy lifting there to give you the one. And the girls do a lot of episodic on their main show. They've also got another one that is serialized that I don't know if you guys really talk about it.
We
enough.
Haven't talked about
you
it.
You really?
At all.
I haven't heard you mention it one time.
Life's busy.
Yeah. So, but yeah, no. In terms of Defense Diaries, I would highly recommend, unless you want to be completely lost by jumping in the middle of it. You start at episode one. They are a major time investment.
Yeah.
First season is 36 episodes, and it's. It's densely packed. I'll put it that way. I'm not bantering much on my pod. So, but it's a good ride. I think you'd enjoy taking the ride with me.
For me, probably my favorite episode would be our Brandon Lawson case. Especially, it's kind of where we turned the tides on our podcast and started being more family focused, victim focused, advocating. It was the first time we had met the family members of the victim. It really changed everything from that point.
You guys had the breakthrough.
Well,
I mean,
yes.
You know, you found the body.
When we released that episode, Hopefully. That was our first one, like Melissa said, that we really were attached to. And before Brandon's case, we were just like you, true crime consumers, and we listened to everything, we watched everything. We didn't really think about the weight that comes with being a true crime content consumer, and that you need to be adamant and what's the word I'm looking for?
Mindful
is
aware.
What I'm looking for.
Yeah,
aware. That's the A word I was looking for. Aware of kind of what you're taking in and where you're voting with your listens. Apparently, Why can't I talk today? I talk for a living. I guess it's the wine. It's probably
maybe the wine.
We're also tired. This is our third show.
It is.
And we drove a lot.
We did drive a lot today.
We did. We drove, what, 3 hours? Plus, I got to go to Bucky's for the first time ever, which was amazing. Well done, Texas. Well done.
It's on my Instagram and their TikTok, so if you want to see Bob's first experience with Bucky's.
It's adorable. But we've
derailed you. Finish your thought.
When we got to Whitney and Jeff's house, Jeff's like, yeah, you know, once you're here for a while, it kind of loses its luster. I was like, dude, for me, it was like magic. It's magical. I was like, what a wonderland of, like, everything.
Stuff.
But back to my conversation here. We quickly transitioned from true crime content consumers to true crime advocates and becoming an ethical podcast, making sure that we are victim forward, we're not victim blaming, and that we aren't sensationalizing anything. We're not talking about how sexy Ted Bundy is, because he's not. He's disgusting. We are really just making sure that we are doing right by the victims and by their families, and thankfully these other human beings are on the same wavelength as us in that manner, and we can kind of come together and push towards ethical true crime.
Yeah, I think it's a huge opportunity for true crime in general to really take away the speculation, take away the sensationalism, and let's talk about the human aspect of crime. You know, these are real people with real tragedies that happen that have destroyed their lives. And these stories need to be treated with respect and with the care that that deserves, in my opinion. And I don't have a favorite case.
Huh?
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I don't have a favorite case, but I do have a case that I have a poster here for Katie Palmer. Has anybody heard the Katie Palmer case? So Grayson County, which is North Texas, in Denison, Texas, Katie Palmer was out on a walk one day with her husband in the morning before she went to work. She was a school teacher. She taught science to middle schoolers. She was well-loved and respected in her community. And as they were walking down the road in the rural neighborhood that they live in, a man named Corey Foster came barreling down the road in a gigantic truck and hit them so hard that they were both knocked out of their shoes and thrown 70 feet into a field. He was appeared to be intoxicated. There was a strong smell of alcohol in his breath. There was never a blood test. There was never breath alcohol analysis. There was never a field sobriety test conducted on this man. He was allowed to leave and go home. And he has never been charged with vehicular manslaughter. They did bring it to a grand jury.
Corey also had weapons in his vehicle.
He had weapons, and he also had...
other police officers allowed him to remove loaded weapons while he had been drinking at the scene of the crime.
And he also had several other drunken driving things on his record. So it's a complete failure by the police and by the prosecution in Grayson County. Brett Smith, in my opinion, is one of the worst DAs in our country. The family is asking that people who care about Katie Palmer's case call Brett Smith and ask him to resign so that somebody can take the place of that position and try this case, because it should be winnable. So listen to my bonus episode with John Palmer. It isn't a New Mexico case, but it's something that really means a lot, and my heart goes out to that family.
I mean... just think for one minute if that was your loved one.
I mean,
for one second, like, you always have to try, as hard as it is, to try to put yourself in someone else's shoes. Imagine if that was your loved one.
It's called empathy.
And that was the result. You know, like, we all got to meet her husband at a podcast festival very recently, and it's just it's heartbreaking. So,
it is.
Like, we really need people to voice their absolute, it's beyond displeasure. It's
the thing with prosecutors or with people that are elected, and their responsibility is to bring charges for cases like this. Sometimes you have to make it politically unpopular for them to ignore you. And that's exactly what John Palmer and Rhonda Nail, who is Katie's mom, have been doing. Actually, Nancy Grace, I think, just covered the case a couple of nights ago. And so it is getting some really good national coverage. The pressure is on Brett Smith, And I can't wait to go out and campaign for the person who's going to beat him in the next election.
Yeah.
And then selfishly, I would say listen to season 2, episode 1, to hear my brother's story. It's a very difficult story to listen to, but I've been fighting for justice for Jacob for 35 years, and so I could use all the support I could get, as well as my mom, to get justice for Jacob. So those are the two cases I would recommend if you want to listen to my show. And let's do hanging out, pictures, talking, and free t-shirts if you're subscribed.
Questions.
What does your shirt say? I love you to the end zone. Hey. Is that a football thing?
Obviously. Okay, okay. No, it's baseball.
Yay, sports. Yeah. Come on, man. Soccer?
I don't know.
I don't know. That's football. Okay, so I have a question. What had you guys go out to San Angelo, Texas? I'm actually from San Angelo.
How did we?
Yeah,
we
what drove. Had you guys no, go out to that for that case?
Oh, and for Brandon Lawson.
I'm in the middle of like West Texas, and nobody really knows San Angelo, so
yeah.
I'm
so
very curious.
It was a case that I had. It was a case that I had had been a part of the Facebook group, Help Find Brandon Lawson. It was one that so many podcasts have covered, trying to interpret or dissect that 911 call. It's just a mind-boggling case. And then one day, Whitney and I decided to go ahead and message that group, the Help Find Brandon Lawson Facebook group, not knowing, like, hey, like, how can we help? What do you got going on? Like, we would love to cover Brandon's story. And a man by the name of Jason Watts, who is the family advocate, he goes and, you know, helps the family navigate all of this. He said, hey, I'm getting... he met us in San Angelo, mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah, it was very quickly after we had messaged him, which he says he gets 100 lots of messages on there, and he only responds to certain ones. So we got lucky
which
on that.
Was later. Shocking because we were a podcast for maybe like 3 months mm-hmm. at this time.
And baby podcast.
We were a baby podcast. Yeah. And he said that he would be out there within a couple of weeks after that message. And so we were both within driving distance, and we said, let's just go. Let's meet him out there, because we wanted to go to where his truck ran out of gas on the side of the road. We wanted to see the cross that's on the side of the road. We wanted to get a visualization for these woods that everyone is talking about, because there's no woods in Texas. It's brush. It's cactus. There's woods don't exist here. Yes, it's not woods.
And lots of dirt in West Texas.
And everybody talked about woods. It's the woods. It's the woods. And so we kind of wanted to visualize it. We're very visual people. We wanted to see it and feel it and just be out there. And Jason met us out there. We talked about Brandon for hours on end. And that evening, Melissa and I got back to the hotel, and we were like, this is what we have to do. We have to go tell these stories and to the best that we can and just help. And Brandon's case has been covered by 118 other podcasts. And me, Melissa, Jason, and 6 other individuals
yep.
were on site in 30-degree weather, 50-mile-an-hour winds, searching 100 acres, and we found it. We found evidence leading to human remains.
What did that feel like?
Absolutely insane, terrifying, relief. Never, oh, crud, that just fell. Never in a million years did we ever think that this was possible, but we were like willing to just help, be there for the family. Hey, this area of land had never been searched before, and I'm going to tell you, it was only 1 mile.
Less than a mile
from where his truck was last, where he ran out of gas on the side of the road.
That's incredible.
1 mile.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
There's
in Bront, Texas.
Outside of Bront.
Yes. And it was actually 1 year to the day that we had met Jason Watts the first time in San Angelo that we had went back to do that foot search. And it was getting towards the end of the day. We were getting tired. We're freezing. And we decided...
Starving,
yes. We decided to search one last area that wasn't quite as rugged terrain. It was because it was brutal all before then. So as soon as we start in this one little area, within 5 minutes, we find the shorts that Brandon was wearing, the exact shorts.
Can you believe that? Like, imagine being out there and like... You're like, holy shit.
That is exactly what we said. We were like,
it must have been incredible.
It was actually Melissa's husband that found the shorts. And then within a literal 30 seconds, someone said, I found a shoe. Mm-hmm. And we flipped over the sole of the shoe, and it was a Nike Air Max. And we knew he was wearing white Nike Air Maxes. We knew he was wearing camo MMA-style shorts. The shorts were inside out, and they were faded. They've been out there for 8.5 years.
They were sun-bleached, definitely.
We used sticks, and were able to see a camo pattern on the inside. And Jason calls their private investigator, and he's like, what do we do? And while the phone is ringing to the private investigator, we find another shoe. And it was within 3 minutes total from shorts to shoe to phone call to a private investigator to get out of the spot. Drop a pin on your phone. Get out of the way. We're calling authorities. And they were there within 45 minutes.
Yeah. And this is really freaky. It is the exact same deputy that came out the night that he ran out of gas and they were searching. The same one came out. We did not tell him we were podcasters because he doesn't like them.
He should now.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, no, I don't know. No.
No.
After 8.5
Screw
years,
him then.
Some crazy white women out there found what they couldn't find. No, yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Like
he's not a good cop. That's what
And it was private property that you found him
it
on.
Was.
Yeah.
And it had never been searched before, but it was within a mile of the truck. Why hadn't it been searched? You know, there's a lot of politics and a lot of property transition between families that happened in the 8.5 years. But at the end of the day, we were able to give a family something that they may not have been able to get otherwise. And we think it's important to tell people that you can advocate very easily. Sharing a Facebook post is a form of advocacy. We like to call what we do action-oriented advocacy. So you don't have to give your time and go do a foot search like we did. You can share a poster. You can hand out a flyer. You can donate to a GoFundMe if you don't want to spend money, just share a Facebook post. That's a way you can help further an investigation in a case. Just be responsible about it, be ethical about it, and you can do this too.
Does anybody feel like a share on social media can be trivial? You feel like it could be trivial?
Oh.
Because I think that it's important to know that that is so important. Like for my brother's case, when Jacob died, there was no media coverage about it at all. There's literally nothing until I started talking about it. And so those shares, while it may seem insignificant, goes a long way because the awareness, like I talked about before, sometimes you have to put political pressure on people to get them to do their jobs. And the more people that are aware, the less likely it is that the people that are responsible for bringing charges will be able to ignore you. And so those shares go a long way. So I honestly feel like sometimes it's even better than money when it comes to helping some of these cases. So just please keep that in mind. Okay, any other questions before we come and hang out with you? No? Cool. Thank you so much for coming out.